Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Blaine Lay and you're listening to Two People. It's a podcast about Richmond and we believe that each one of us is two people. So your personal self and your public self and who you are is at the intersection of the two. So each episode of the show, we interview someone from around town about their personal background and how that comes to life publicly and the work they do. Today on the show, I sit down with LeVar Stoney. He's the former Secretary of the Commonwealth of Virginia. And as you probably already know, he's running for mayor. And he shares a little bit about his background. He talks about the role his grandmother played in raising him. He shares about his early experiences in school, learning to read, playing football. And he also talks about how he got into public life. LeVar also shares some insights about his relationship with his dad. His dad was convicted of a felony, and LeVar talks a little bit about how that connects to his work with rights restoration. And what would an interview like this be if we didn't ask about some issues in our city? I asked LeVar about education and economic development, and we also talked through his philosophy for collaboration and how you can actually make that a reality. And at the very end, we play a game. It's not quite a lightning round. It's more of a moderately paced round of questions. LeVar gives me a fashion tip. We get to hear about one of his female heroes. And do we sing a song? I don't know. Maybe. It's possible. You're just going to have to listen and find out. This is episode 24 with LeVar Stoney. You're listening to Two People. Stoney.
Hey.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We are here in, I would call it Ground Zero.
That's right.
Of the Stoney headquarters in an undisclosed location here in Richmond, Virginia.
This is the brain trust right here.
Yeah,
this
man.
This is the operation.
This is the belly of the beast.
Mm-hmm.
The grit, the buzzing epicenter.
That's right.
If you will.
That's right.
Thank you for being on the show.
Well, thank you.
I know you're a busy man. I wanted to start at the beginning, and I wanted to ask about your story. A lot of times it's Mr. Stoney, you have 2 minutes to tell us about yourself, who you are, what you stand for. And I think a lot of times when you talk about your story, it's three bullet points, but this is a life that you lived.
Yeah.
So I wanted to start just by read back to you literally the copy from your most recent TV ad. Mm-hmm. So the ad says, "I know what it feels like to not have a mom around, to have a teenage dad not finish high school, to be able to afford field trips, to be on free and reduced lunch, to have no one help with homework." Hmm. When you go back, can you just characterize and just tell me the story of those early stages in your life?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm every day I talk about me being a product of kids having kids. What that really means is, you know, a mother that was 16, a father that was 19. My mother, when I was born, my father had that hesitation that many fathers have when they're that young,
right?
Particularly in my community, whether, like, you know, is it mine? Will I do what I'm supposed to do? And that is stand up and actually claim that it's mine.
Right.
And I, from what my dad's story is, that early on, he did not do that.
Right.
But in a matter of a week, you know, he came by and he was like, "No, this is my child. I stand by it." The people in my family have always taken care of their children,
right?
Always. And so my dad, he came in, but they both had no skills to really raise a child. And so the lucky part is that my grandmother and my grandfather were around.
Is that on your father's side?
On my father's side.
Okay.
And so Mary Stoney, Abraham Stoney, and in a matter of months, I was born March of 1981. My grandfather passed away in November of 1981.
Uh-huh.
I'm one of the only few grandchildren, that actually got to actually meet my grandfather.
Okay.
I don't remember it, obviously, but he was obviously the patriarch that people, that the stories are still, I hear my uncle still tell stories about my grandfather. He was just, a war veteran.
Is there one story that stands out from your grandfather?
The one thing about my grandfather is, they like to say he was a rolling stone.
Uh-huh. Right.
But, even when those stories come up, my grandmother loved him so much. And she would just smile through all those stories.
Right.
And it just showed a loyalty between two people that you really can't understand.
Right.
Right? And a story that my grandmother, she had kids early. She had two kids early, and one of them was my uncle's. Two of them were my uncles, and my grandfather was left for like a couple years,
right,
and then came back, and she took him back.
Wow.
And I'm just like, wow, that doesn't happen these days.
I mean, that just speaks to her character.
She right? is a strong woman, right? I mean,
she's still with us?
No, she's not. Okay. She's not. You know, after being sworn in as Secretary of the Commonwealth a few months into the term, she passed away.
Gotcha.
And she suffered from Alzheimer's for a long period of time.
Wow.
But back to, you know, that's kind of stands out, that the relationship her and granddad had, or, you know, that was something that kind of I marveled at, because he wasn't the best husband.
Right.
And it didn't sound like he was also, you know, he wasn't the best father, but they loved him that much. Mm. I mean, he was their rock, and then she became the rock of the family. And when he passed away, I became like, as my grandmother would tell me, I became her little husband, basically. And she put all her love, all her time, all her energy into me.
And she basically raised you, right?
Yeah, she basically raised me.
Was that from birth, or was it?
Basically from, you know, while? My mom was around and whatnot, but I think I always stayed with the grandma. I mean,
right.
I never lived ever with my mom.
Ah, okay.
So where I slept every night was with grandma at grandma's house. I mean, that was always the case. And they had my brother after me, you know, 2 years after me. My brother stayed with my mom, and my brother had, what's it called? Meningitis early on.
Okay.
And I think it comes from not having the greatest parenting skills, not right. washing the bottles out correctly enough. And he had bacterial meningitis early on. And, you know, the nickname for him was Dead or Alive, because they didn't know whether he was going to survive or whether or not he was going to die. And after all that, he came to live with us. And I remember that when he finally just stayed with us all the time.
How old were you then when he came to live with you?
So I have a pretty, really, really, you know, I have a really good memory. It had to be 1985.
So you're like 4 years
four
old?
4 years old.
Okay.
4 years when he permanently just came to live with us.
Okay.
And dad lived with grandma most of the time. My mother really stayed out of it. But it came 1988 when my 19-year-old uncle, my dad's little brother, died in a serious car accident on an icy road. And that was the moment where it kind of changed. It changed all of our lives, I think. It was such a shock. And we were living in Long Island in New York. And that's when we decided that we were going to move to Virginia with where my uncle lived. And that was in Hampton Roads. And he said, come down to Virginia. There's opportunity here. Mm-hmm. You can get a job. So my grandmother took me and my brother. We moved to Hampton Roads. Stayed with my uncle for a little bit. Before getting on our feet, getting the insurance payout for my uncle dying, and we moved into an apartment, and I think my father came down that Christmas of 1988 as a surprise. We're like, Dad came down, and Dad stayed with us permanently as well.
Ah, okay.
And so that kind of got things going. I remember entering school there. I went to I did first grade in New York, and it was interrupted. So I didn't finish first grade, so I ended up going to first grade twice. When my parents enrolled me, they didn't enroll me in kindergarten, so I didn't go to kindergarten. I started right at first grade. And, you know, I knew how to do pop, top, cop, all that stuff on the refrigerator.
Right.
But I really never had any true, like, you know, socialization with other children or anything right. like that. So going to that classroom at that time, I was, like, scared. And I didn't even know how to read, really.
Did you know, like, to what extent did you have an awareness that either you weren't where you should be, or how much? It just seems like that was a very tumultuous time in your life, where you don't have the stability, you don't know, is Dad going to be here, where are we going to live, where am I going to go to school? What was, and again, going back to the ad, you talk about, I know what it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
What did that feel like?
You know, for us, it was just everyday life, right? Like, you know, you see this every day. You're thinking, you know,
you don't know anything different.
You don't know anything different. So when you see, whether you see violence, whether you see, you know, I felt alone when your mother's not around. But I knew the mother I really only knew was my grandma. And
right.
so for a time in my life, I just called her mom. And I remember my mom not being very happy with that.
Right.
And she said, I'm your mother. That's your grandmother. And so totally corrected me and my brother from saying, you know, chastise us for saying that. And so we changed it up to say, hey, grandma, hey, grandma. And so that right there stood out to me. I remember that vividly, that she got visually upset about us calling her mom.
Right.
When my dad's calling her mom, my uncle who lived with us called her mom, all I knew was she was mom.
Mom to you.
Mom to me.
Right.
And I remember when I was in elementary school in New York, and you know when you're like not in the, I was in a low reading group.
Mm-hmm.
And even though—
So you got the red group, the yellow group, the green
exactly
group.
Exactly right. And I was in the red group. And the green group was like the top group. And I was like, huh, they're reading like Mr. Fig or something like that. And I'm reading like some low level book. And I'm just like, I don't know. Something's not right here. And I remember going home and my dad, you know, he'd never really took the time sometimes to actually help me with my homework and all that. But this one time he was like, let's do this. It was like a Saturday and we started reading the book together. And he was like, just string these words together. That's how you read. You string them together. And it just clicked. It just clicked. I took that back to class and my teacher was like, wow, this guy can read now. Like,
look at this guy.
Yeah,
look
this guy, he can read.
Look at this red group guy.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, I'm trying to go to the green group now, everybody. And so—
Excuse me, step aside.
And that's what I remember. It just clicked.
I'm about to be up in here.
Yeah. When I got to Virginia, though, totally different world. I remember being going to a classroom that was all black, then going to a classroom that was mostly white.
Mm-hmm.
And I was scared out of my mind the first day of school.
What were you scared of?
I'd never, ever interacted with white people before. Never. And, you know, growing up in my home, you know, it was always like, you know, be careful around white people now.
Hmm.
Right? You know, like, oh, be careful. And getting in there and like, you know what? My dad always told me I could compete with anyone, no matter how they look, no matter where they came from. And that kind of like drove me. I didn't have a chip on my shoulder.
Right.
It was more of a, yeah, I'm just as good as anyone in here. And I think hold a little of that with me today. Like I can walk in any room and compete with anyone, no matter what college they went to, no matter where they're from, no matter where they grew up or how much money they may have or where they may come from, I can compete with anyone.
Right.
And that's sort of, I think that's a competitive nature that my dad kind of instilled in me and my brother.
Yeah.
And so when I talk about in that ad of like, no, not having someone to help me out with homework, you know, I didn't have that. You know, I came home, there were times I wasn't allowed to take home the books because we couldn't afford the user fees on the books.
Right.
I remember being in second grade and having spelling homework or reading homework, or language arts homework, and I would rush to finish it during the day. I would do the work in class, then I would do the homework all at the same time. So I knew—
In class.
In class, before the bell rang, before I had to jump on the bus.
I got a deadline. I can't take this book home.
That's right.
This
I can't take this book home. Now, I think about it, like, would they have known? But back then, there was like, no, you can't take the book home. I was just like, sheesh, this is pretty tight.
Come on, I'm trying to learn over here.
And so I would actually get off the bus and run and do my homework as quick as I could. When I got to school. I made the honor roll all throughout elementary school. I remember getting to, you know, when you get upper in like middle school and high school, you need a little bit more help in your homework. And, you know, I never got that.
Right.
I was able always to help my brother out. But, you know, schoolwork kind of always came easy to me. And so my dad kind of always thought, you know, he'll be all right, you know.
So today, LeVar Stoney, Secretary of the Commonwealth, running for mayor, like you've made it, right? And there are a lot of young men like you that have not made it. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, what was the key to you making it the way that you did? How much of that was just like, you grew up with some grit? Is it the support? A little bit of both?
The difference, I think, number one, I have to recognize my parents, my grandmother and my father. They were the reinforcement, right? Like, you know, they damn sure did not know how to do the homework, but they damn sure made sure I did the homework.
Right.
They supplied the discipline. Families sometimes aren't given these days. And so I did my homework. I knew there were consequences if I didn't do homework. I knew there was consequences if I didn't go to school and behaved.
Mm-hmm.
And those consequences were like, you know, they were, let's just say they drove me, okay? Parents don't discipline the way that we were disciplined back in, you know, the 80s and the 90s. They don't do that anymore. But that's the way, that was the threat that hung over our heads. I took heed to those threats. My brother, not so much.
Right.
You know, and he would say that, I think. But also, I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for coaches and teachers who, you know what, they didn't look like me.
Mm-hmm. Because you went to high school in Yorktown.
Yorktown.
You went to TAB.
Yeah.
And you, because you played football, you were involved in drama.
Yeah, played football.
What position did you play?
I played quarterback.
Ah, okay.
I played quarterback. I started off in middle school as like a tight end, defensive back. And then in junior varsity, they needed a quarterback. And I was like, well, I've always wanted to be a quarterback. Mm-hmm. Because quarterback to me means leadership. And I've always been really into leading, not following. And when I tried out for quarterback, and I was like, we're going to make it a quarterback. And I was like, yes. I didn't even know. Here's the funny thing. I didn't even know I was going to. I tried out for the football team, and it was not enough individuals for JV, for the junior varsity team. And so I was getting creamed every day.
Because were you on varsity? Or you were getting creamed just as.
We played with the seniors and the juniors. And so, because we didn't have enough for junior varsity just yet. And I was like, I don't know if I really want to do this anymore because I'm sore. I'm not going to play. I'm not going to be a tackling dummy all, you know, all summer long, all season long. And so I remember this. I go home. I'm really sore. I'm asking for the Bengay and all that stuff. You know, I'm icing and everything. And my dad would come pick me up. He was a high school janitor locally. He would come pick me up from work and take me to my second practice. All right? I was moping around slowly, like getting myself together. To go to the car.
I don't know if I want to do this.
I don't know if I want to do this or anything like that. You know, he could read it on me. Like, I didn't say it, you know, I didn't verbally say I didn't want to do this, but I was basically making my mind up to quit.
Right.
And I was trying to bring myself to say it to dad. I was like, I don't think I want to do this anymore. But he already knew it. You know, your parents are very perceptive. He was like, I know what's going on here. You want to quit, don't you? And I said, yeah, actually, dad, I do want to quit. And he kept on driving. And I remember he parked me right in the parking lot around in front of practice, and he said to me, if you quit now, you'll be quitting for the rest of your life. You'll be giving yourself permission to quit at any little obstacle that comes along your path. And I think about it now, just because I wasn't playing, I was sore, that little, like, that's inconsequential when you look back at it now. But that was going to drive me to quit. And there are certain people out there who have a whole lot more obstacles in front of them. And they're not quitting. I was going to quit over something like that. And I've never quitted anything.
So you went back and played?
I went back and played. I started at quarterback. I was at sophomore year. I started at quarterback on the varsity team.
Wow,
all
right.
And I started all 4 years.
So let that be a lesson to you, young LeVar.
That's yeah. Don't quit.
You should you should get like a time machine and go back and tell yourself, be like, you're going to run for mayor. This is an important moment.
That's right. That's
show up like a hologram.
Yeah, that's right. Who knew? Who knew back then?
And you spent some time. You weren't just a high school quarterback, but did you take a drama class? I read. Is that a true thing?
Yeah, I did. You know, you select electives, and I was really into drama. Actually never actually participated in the play because I was so into football and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But they wanted me to be the plant in what's it called? Little Shops of Horror.
Oh.
Feed me, Seymour, feed me.
Okay. You still got it.
I got a little bit of it. Got a little bit. Feed me. So I never got to do any plays or whatnot, but I was pretty good, I thought at least. And then I did student government. I've been doing student government ever since I was in elementary school. I lost one election along the way. Maybe I actually lost two. Tried to be student rep in third grade, lost to this other guy. He didn't really want to do
it.
You
know who you lost to?
I wanted to do it. Bobby Hedrick.
Oh, Bobby.
Bobby's a good friend. he was my wide receiver in high school. So,
he made amends.
We made amends.
Do you remember what your platform is when you're running for like second grade?
No, I do remember this though. I remember
no homework.
No. I remember the slogans like "Forget the baloney, vote for Stoney."
I feel like when you're
LeVar will take you far.
Yeah,
you know, with my picture, like
Can I rhyme this somehow?
Yeah, exactly right. That's what people want. And I think I let a friend of mine actually. Like handled the posters one time, and he just started like writing some stuff on there that I didn't really like pay attention to, and the teacher was like, this is LeVar, this is inappropriate. And I was like, okay, I'll take it down and just stick to the rhymes. I think.
Right. Let me talk to my campaign.
Yeah. Student body president in middle school and student body president in high school.
Go ahead. And then at JMU, you got involved there as well, right?
Yep. I was recruited to play football after high school. Randolph-Macon came calling. Hamden, Sydney, I believe, VMI came calling, a couple other like Division III, Division II colleges. I just thought, you know what, I'm not going to the NFL. Had an opportunity probably to walk on at JMU. I decided not to do that either. I said, you know what I really love doing? I love this leadership politics stuff. And I got involved, ran for my hall senator, lost that, but became an at-large senator. Chosen, which is rare for a freshman to be chosen.
Did you say your hall senator?
Yeah.
Was there a representative from each hall?
Each hall, each like dormitory had a representative. And I ran for that and I lost to I know her name, Stephanie LaBuzz. She's an attorney, I think, up in Philadelphia now, and lost to her. But I got selected by, the executive council to be an at-large senator as a freshman.
Were you surprised by that?
I didn't. I mean, I wasn't surprised, but I was... they told me, I was like, yeah, this is rare. We don't normally pick freshmen to be an at-large senator. We normally give them the people who we know and whatnot. Right. So
this is the early 2000s.
Yeah, this is, yeah.
I've done my research, so there's some great throwback pictures of you featuring some early 2000s fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Some large jeans, like a one-strap backpack.
Yeah.
Some solid sweaters.
Yeah, some solid turtleneck sweaters from...
did you study anything in that realm? Like what got you interested in that world?
I had been interested in politics back in like high school, I guess. Did a lot of reading through elementary school, middle school. When we went to the library and we had library day, everybody was picking out the bear sting bears and,
classic,
Cat in the Hat and all that stuff. And I was like, I don't want those books. I want those books over there, those biographies of every president in the United States. And they were like, you're in first grade. You're not supposed to check those out. I was like, I want those. So they gave it to me. I didn't know how to read them a lot of times, but I tried. And I became interested in like politics that way.
Right.
John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, things of that nature. That kind of got me really interested.
You say, what is this Berenstain Bears? I'm trying to learn about some John F. Kennedy.
Yeah, that's right. I'm trying to learn about the Kennedys right now. Don't give me that book.
Excuse me.
And so that's what I really got interested in. And then when I got to high school, I had AP government. And I got a 5. I was one of the only people in the whole grade to get a 5
That's
on the
legit.
AP government test.
You can't get higher than a 5.
That's right. That's all you can get. And so when I got 5 in AP government, I was like, I think I know what I'm going to major in.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's all laid out. And so I got in. Unlike some people, I knew what I wanted to do. I started studying political science and public administration as well. And that kind of set my course right there.
Right.
Worked on a couple campaigns, ran a field operation for a House of Delegates race in 2003.
And this is all while you were in school?
In school, okay. Yeah. I interned for Mark Kennedy Shriver. I was always in love with the Kennedys.
Mm-hmm.
Got involved in Mark Kennedy Shriver's race in Maryland. And then I got the bug. And after that, I actually I graduated and I begged myself into this fellowship program for the governor at the time, Mark Warner, and didn't have the highest GPA. Because I was so busy taking care of the campus's problems, the student body president. But I begged and begged, was very persistent, and they accepted me as a fellow in Mark Warner's fellowship program. And so that's where I met that's my move to Richmond.
So you dipped
right
your toe into the water and that's you got to Richmond. So I want to pause you there before we get to the Richmond phase of your life. So in high school and college, you were the first in your family to graduate. What was that like? Either high school or college, when you walked across the stage?
Oh, man. Sheesh, when I was in college particularly, I vividly remember I shed so many tears. And my uncle, my dad was like, why are you crying? I was like, this is big. Like, my dad was, he always, when he would, tell us stories when I was a kid, before bedtime, he would make this story up about a kid going to college. He kind of pounded it into our heads about, you're going to college, you're going to college, you're going to college. And my dad was like, he told me particularly that I could change the trajectory of my family. And that's a lot of pressure on a, 17, 18-year-old. And I remember one time my brother was like, why are you doing all this study and why do all this work? Like, we're not going to college. You can't even afford to go to college. So you're just not going to happen.
What'd you say to him?
And I was like, I'm going to college. I'm gonna prove it to you. I'm gonna go into college. And you know, when I graduated from high school, I mean, boy, I shed some tears then. But I was on a mission, you know. So mm-hmm. the tears really came running down when I walked across that stage at James Madison. I mean, with my family all there, my dad was there, and I get, you know, there's pictures of me giving him the biggest hug because you know, that was our goal that we shared together. And so when my dad passed away, I gave him my my diploma. Oh, I had a copy of my diploma.
Oh, wow.
And I put it in his casket with him because it was our shared goal.
Wow.
And so, you know, it was for me, but it was for him. Hmm. It was for him. Because, you know, when you're 19 and you have a child, you don't get to really fulfill any of your dreams. So all your dreams are through your children.
Right.
And so going to college was just as much his dream as it was my dream as well.
Because he was sweeping floors as a custodian and mm-hmm. trying to make sure you guys were doing your homework.
Mm-hmm. And here's the thing, you know, even though he, you know, when he passed away, you know, New Year's Eve 2011. When I went to the school to get all his belongings and whatnot, you know, he had pictures of like me and my brother, and everybody would say, you know, how proud he was of us. And he would always tell us he was proud of us, but everybody was like, he is so proud of you guys. And dad was a proud guy because like, no one wants to be a janitor. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, but all the kids at that high school, they loved him. They loved him. Like, you know, like, and they came through like when his funeral was, for a guy who was just a janitor, it was so packed. There was so many people there. Mm. I'm sure they were there for me, but they also were there for him as well. And I just remember saying, like, you know what? If I could take with me how proud my dad was about his work, you know, he would show me. He was like, look how shiny these floors are.
Yeah.
You know?
And there's something honorable about that I don't think people, like you said, just a janitor. I think sometimes it's easy to forget people that are, like, you're working in a toll booth or you're mopping floors or somebody that cleans my office. There's an honor and integrity to doing that job well, right?
You want to be the best at doing it. And my dad always taught me to be, whatever you do, be the best at it. You know, let folks remember your work.
Right.
And so, you know, when I worked myself up the ladder to get to be Secretary of the Commonwealth, I wanted people to remember our work because a lot of folks don't get an opportunity to do,
right,
to be the Secretary of the Commonwealth and growing it the way I did, you know? And so, you know, I think our work will be remembered,
mm-hmm.
Particularly on the felon restoration stuff, on the restoration of voting rights. I mean, that sort of stuff matters.
I've always sensed that this is a personal issue for you because mm-hmm. you talk about how important your dad was, how much he shaped you. And he was convicted before you in like 2008 or so. Like I read that he was able to vote in the 2008 election.
That's right.
He mm-hmm. was convicted of a felony in New York. And that this is kind of when you haven't become the Secretary of the Commonwealth yet. This is still in your early days. And is it right that you urged him to pursue the restoration of rights in New York? Like, I'm just curious about what those conversations were like with you.
You know, I knew Dad did not vote. And it wasn't explained to me he didn't vote until he actually said to, like, you know, well, I have a felony on record. And I was like, let me do a little research then for you, Dad. And so in college, I did a lot of research. And then when I started working on campaigns, like the first couple of campaigns he couldn't participate in that I worked on, the one I worked in 2002, the one I worked in, I think in 2003, I worked in one he couldn't participate in. I was like, I got to find a fix for this because he wants to get involved in what I'm doing. Just like a parent who wanted to get involved in their child's sport, he wanted to get involved in what I was doing. And so I found out once you are paid your debt to society and you've, mm-hmm. You're done with your conviction, your incarceration, you can vote in New York. And I was like, Dad, you know, you're good. And you should go register to vote. And he did. And he participated in every election after that. I did give him a hard time. 2005, he did not vote in that race. And the guy I worked for lost by 300 votes. And I did not talk to him for like a month.
Wow.
Because when you lose by 300 votes, that's one vote, like, you know, a precinct or something like that. in Virginia, and I was super upset with him. But after that, he voted every time he could. What made him the proudest, though, was that I was working to elect the first African-American president of the United States.
Right.
And he was so into that election. He was so into it. He, he would randomly go to people and say, hey, young man, you should be thinking about voting. And he remembered telling me a story. He said, I was at the Waffle House in like Newport News or somewhere, and like I was trying to tell these young guys that, hey, you should vote. There's a big election coming up. I'm going to get a black man as president. And these guys, they weren't trying to hear any of that. And they were like, you better back up, man. You better back up. I don't want to care about some damn voting. And they like showed him a firearm. And he was like, okay, all right. Just trying to, but that's how far he went, I think.
Right.
Trying to get people to vote. Yeah, right. He's trying to get out the vote for President Obama.
Can I just get some eggs?
All yeah. Right, you guys get. I was like, Dad, thank you for doing your part, but you don't have to go that far,
brother.
Be safe.
So I want to kind of transition and talk about city things in just a second. So you worked for Mark Warner. You had a role in the state party. You worked, mm-hmm. You've worked closely with Governor McAuliffe as a private citizen, and now formerly Secretary of the Commonwealth. What was memorable? What are you most proud of when you look at your tenure as a secretary?
I'm most proud of those moments where when I got to see, you never thought that when you're working behind the scenes, the number of years I worked behind the scenes, whether it's executive director of the Democratic Party or as a simple field organizer back in the day, you just knew that you were a part of the apparatus, right? Like, you didn't know. I knew I was making some sort of an effect on change, but you didn't know what you were really. But when you're actually there,
mm-hmm.
you're like, okay, we're here. We need to make some change happen. And we did that through the restoration of one's voting rights and civil rights. And when folks received those grant orders from me or from the governor, and they broke down and cried right there, shed tears right there. Gosh, that's what public service, that's what this is all about. It made all those times I knocked on doors and had doors slammed in my face, or all those times that I went and recruited volunteers. It made it all those times for the number of years I worked behind the scenes matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow, we really, right here in this seat, we really get to affect people's lives, impact people's lives. Seeing those tears, seeing that joy, man, that really got me going again. Because you know what? When you work behind the scenes for a number of years, you get jaded by the process because you see back and forth negativity, and you're just like, why would anyone want to do anything like this?
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
Like, why would anyone want to put themselves through this?
Dang, this is stressful. I don't know why people do this.
This is silly. Like, you can predict what's going to happen. But when I got there and I was like, when I got to be behind the scenes and kind of driving some of the governor's agenda, whether it's in job creation or driving, ensuring that women get the right to access to proper health care here in Virginia, I was like, wow, we get to actually put the stuff that we talked about on the trail into action. That's true social action right there. That got me going. And I mean, I will always remember those tears, though. Those people who were like, they thought they were second-class citizens, and we, gave them a voice.
Yeah. And how do you do that with something that's so close to your heart, but it's also a political, there's a political reality to it, mm-hmm. right? Like, you read the paper, and I think you hear this from both sides, that on the Republican side, they'll say, this is political, McAuliffe's just jamming it through. And I think on the Democratic side, they'll say, this is political, like, they're just jamming us up, they won't let us get done what we want to get done. And I think on both sides, there are partisan hacks, and on both sides, there are also good people trying to do good work.
That's right.
So how do you think about addressing legitimate disagreement on something with someone from the other side and still get things done?
My thing about, disagreement in politics is this. I think we share the same map, right? We want the best for the city,
right,
for the state, for the country. We just have different compasses and where we're going on that map. And so I don't, I hate when politics becomes uncivil. That's the stuff that really, really turns me off. Like, I hate that. The mm-hmm. stuff I've been reading and seeing about Donald Trump and the divisiveness, I hate that. That's not what this country is. That's not what this state is. That's not what this city is. I think people attach themselves to hope. They attach themselves to things that make them feel good. People are, I think, aspirational. They want what's good. And so I like to put all that to the side and say, all right, how do we make this work for everyone?
Right.
How do we get to the win-win? That's what I'm always looking for. And so that's why, as Secretary of the Commonwealth, yeah, you know what? I am a proud progressive. Mm-hmm. Folks know that about me. I don't shy away from being a Democrat. But there, I have a number of friends on the other side who would say, I think that I'm a decent and transparent guy who you can easily get along with.
Right.
And I think that's why I'm good friends with people like Chris Peace in Hanover, mm-hmm. because
he's a Republican.
He's a Republican, but you know, we're good friends. I have a number. That's why when I go sit down with the Speaker of the House, who is a Republican and who hasn't had the greatest relationship with the governor, you know, he gives me advice on being a public servant.
Right.
You know, asking me like, "You sure you really want to do this, LeVar?" When I talk to him about running for mayor, he's like, "You know, the city could use some energy, a guy like you."
I want to hear more stories like that. Like and maybe people aren't interested in these two guys are getting along. Like that's just not what draws people.
That doesn't. Yeah, and I'll tell you something
happens,
else.
But how do you highlight the good?
When I left the office of Secretary of the Commonwealth, what surprised me was I got two letters from two Republican legislators. One was Tommy Norman, and one was Jackson Miller in Manassas. Both Republicans, both pretty devout Republicans. The funny thing is Jackson Miller was the fellow who questioned whether or not I should be appointed to Secretary of the Commonwealth. And, you know, I went and saw every single Republican legislator during my confirmation and appointment process. And he was one of the ones who gave me a little resistance in the beginning. But we turned out to be pretty good friends.
Did that surprise you when you got that letter?
It did surprise me. He was like, "I hope when you win that you don't act all brand new and we can actually get a beer together." And I was like, that's what it's all about. Yeah. But no one ever really hears about that part there, right?
Yep.
You know, they want to hear about the partisan noise that kind of divides us.
Right.
But there's a lot that actually brings us together.
Yep. Can we talk city questions?
Sure.
Let's get into the walkery. Here we go. That is the city theme song now, apparently, for the city conversation. So you talk about the first 100 days.
Yeah.
You're going to audit every department. You're going to take a look. Do you have a sense on this side of doing that? What is working well? What needs to be improved?
You know, working well, I point to the mayor's efforts on the Office of Community Wealth Building. For a mayor to take on the difficult issue of solving poverty in one city that's not an easy thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate and give full recognition to the fact that this mayor has tried to take that head on, bringing the resources together, bringing the partners and stakeholders to the table to tackle something that plagues the city, has plagued the city for a very, very long time. And he's gotten national recognition for that, and that should not be, overlooked. Mm-hmm. I think that's working out well.
Essentially the national model.
Yeah,
right.
That's right. And it comes from, that's a good use of the mayor being the grand convener on a subject that that plagues not only the city, but also plagues the region. What's not working well in City Hall, I think, is the ability to actually provide the basic services that people desire and pay for. You know, we pay a premium to live in the city. And the fact that we're not even getting adequate services should bother everyone.
Right.
You know, but to me, it's not just about the potholes and the sidewalks and the alleys and the inability to actually to get a CAFA on time or the high grass. Those are symptomatic of a larger problem.
Right.
And that is a lack of leadership, a lack of hands-on, visible, transparent, and accountable leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that may not be the all-out remedy, but that will take City Hall to a whole new level.
But how much of that is like technology, systems, workflows versus people, culture, belief? Is it both and?
I think it's both. I think, number one, you got to invest in human capital. That means putting the right people in the right seats. Competent individuals who can run sometimes complicated programs, you know, software. I mean, those, it starts with the people, I think. But then number two, it starts with someone who, culture is a major thing for me. In any office I've ever, any organization I've ever run, culture is the number one thing I think the CEO, the executive can actually drive. And so I want us to be a responsive team. You know, when it comes to residential responsiveness, we've got to be responsive to the people who pay the bills. I want us to be an organization that embraces and encourages technology and innovation. We got to be creative. We can't run government the same way we ran it 20 years ago. That's just, if you want to compete with these other cities, you got to get those things right. And that means we may have some antiquated, out-of-dated sort of, you know, processes. And controls within city government that could be easily reformed with new ideas. And that's, I see my role as the next mayor, as the person who's supposed to drive the agenda, drive the narrative, and drive the culture.
Yeah, the role is really interesting to me because it is part technical casting vision, but it's also, a lot of it is symbolic. Can you get people aligned around a vision? You know, the CAO obviously does a lot of the day-to-day and stuff like that. I want to ask about schools.
Yeah.
This is a big issue. Education. Yeah. You've got a plan. I have printed it off. I'm ruffling
six
the papers.
Pages right there, right? Roughly.
You can read this. You can read this on your computer, or you don't have to print it off.
StonyForRVA.com.
It's a fascinating report. And did Thad Williamson help?
Thad Williamson, a number of people, teachers, parents,
had their fingerprints
on all this. We did a roundtable right here in this room at my headquarters putting this together. And this is the social justice issue of our time. It's a dual imperative, though. It's not only the morally right thing to do, but it's economically the right thing for us to do as well.
And I think it's interesting because there's a lot of the language in here recognizes that it's not the mayor's role, particularly on budgeting. And it recognizes, hey, the superintendent, he or she is the person that is going to be driving a lot of this.
Yeah, they're the chief education officer.
Right.
There's a role for the mayor to play.
Certainly. You talk about state funding, particularly how the local composite index. We're getting super wonky here, but the LCI.
Put our wonky hats on.
Can you
here.
Just talk about how state protractors. Funding works? Yeah, exactly. Pocket protectors.
Yeah, I said protractors. That's for geometry, I think.
Yeah. How does state funding? How does that formula work?
Well, the local composite index recognizes Richmond as a wealthy locality because it takes into consideration land values, property values, and so they see those tall buildings downtown, and it looks like Richmond is a pretty wealthy locality.
Right.
What it doesn't account for is the fact that 40% of our children are living under the poverty line. And so it also rewards localities who have high or continuing growth in enrollment.
Right.
And so places like Chesterfield and Henrico receive more dollars for their students than Richmond receives for theirs or for ours, because they are growing enrollments, and a place like Loudoun County, which is one of the richest counties in all of America, receives more dollars for their students than we do, and I think that it's wrong. It's wrong. And for me, politics and public service has always been about righting wrongs. And this is a clear wrong in state policy. And I think you have to account. It takes more bodies. It takes more services to educate a child who's living in the trauma of poverty every single day. When that trauma and poverty enters your doors of your schools, one person, it takes more than one body in the classroom.
Right.
The teachers that we currently have are, I think, do a great job. They're wearing so many different hats, though. They're mom, dad, psychologist, you name it, every single day. My job as mayor is to improve the quality of life of the child.
Right.
So when they enter those doors, teachers can do what they do well, and that is teach. and educate. And I'll wrap every service possible inside City Hall around the child, whether it's Parks and Recs or social services. That's what I think the role of the mayor is, opening up City Hall and partnering with the superintendent, the school board, and the city council to get things done.
Yeah. There isn't sufficient, like essentially a steady stream of funding. And I'm wondering the degree to which funding will solve all of our problems. Like, I think you hear about efficiency in schools. At some point, we're going to need to right size when we're looking at how populations are moving. But how do you think about the role of funding? It's certainly necessary, but is that sufficient to fully solve the whole problem?
No, it is not sufficient to fund the whole problem. Here's the thing. I could easily be a mayor who says, I put an extra $5 million. I put an extra $10 million in your budget and just, you know, wash my hands of the situation and say, I've done my part. But I think there's a whole lot more than just, you know, the money side. I think the mayor has to be the person who recognizes and highlights the successes that many of our children and many of our teachers are having inside our system. And I think what happens a lot is people want to write that story about Richmond being a failing school system. They'd rather write that story than write the story about the successes that people just like I was, the kid just like me, what they're going through and actually succeeding.
Right.
No one's writing about that. But the mayor can also be the person that I talk about every day, when I talk about collaboration, who brings all these players to the table, brings the city council, the school board, the superintendent to the table, and is able to actually write out what the next 5-10 years look like in Richmond public education. And I call that a compact, and that's in my education plan, where we can lay out, here's our shared goals, here are our shared outcomes, and here are our shared strategies. Other cities are doing this. You know, Denver is doing this. Miami is doing this. If we want to avoid those, the confrontational, adversarial fights we see every single year, you got to get around the table and say, this is the part we're all going to play.
Right. And I think what you're describing essentially is the nature of collaboration, right? I think what is true now is a lot of folks aren't seeing collaboration and everybody being on the same page the way they'd like. I think that's true between the mayor's office, the school board, the superintendent, city council. I think that's true in the city. And I think it's also true regionally when you look at things like baseball and transportation and how can we actually get things done the way that we would like. I think as a citizen, a lot of folks just want to see elected officials on the same page. And I'm wondering about what are the barriers that you see to that collaboration? Is it a function of personalities or is it a structural challenge in terms of the way that things are set up? It's probably both and again.
But it's both, but you know, to blame it on structure and blame and make that the challenge is just a cop out to me. You know, when you want to get something done, you can do that by, you know, you just have to be focused on what the outcome is going to be. When you know, if you want a positive outcome to anything, particularly anything that's government related, policy related, you got to be like, you know what? We're not leaving this table. We're not leaving this room until we find a solution.
Right.
The issue before us, the problem before us, it's too critical. You know, the future of the city is at stake. And so for folks to say, you know, I'm going to run back to my corner and not, to me, that's unacceptable.
I'm going to take my ball and go home.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. So that means we have to cut out the political theater, which that game is played out. I've seen it for the last couple of years now on the threats of we're going to close schools here in our city. That game is, all you do is create enemies that way. And so folks ask me how I'm going to work with city council, how I'm going to work with school board, and say, well, you got to learn how to count to 5, LeVar. And say, no. I got to learn how to count to 9. Because you're never going to know. You never know when you're going
to
need.
So you're saying you would need 5 votes on city council to get something done.
Yeah. Folks think all you need is 5 votes.
Yeah.
All you need is 5 votes. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, you need
just
more
get 5
than,
people.
Just get 5 people. But when you do that, you just say, you know what? My focus is going to be on these 5 people. You create 4 enemies. And those 4 enemies can, even though you have the majority, let's say, they can take down whatever project you may, you know, or whatever idea you may have very easily.
Right.
By running to the press, running to the media and saying this, this, and that. And they're poking holes into a plan that could be helpful to many, many people in the city. So that's why you need to think beyond 5 votes.
development in the city. You can think about this a lot of ways. Certainly events and arts, when you think about the bike race or putting these large artistic installations down by the river, they're talking about these rings. But also in the business sense, I think Stone's gotten a lot of press in the last mm-hmm. year. And when we think about business development, it's about tax revenue, right? Mm-hmm. So we've got 62 square miles mm-hmm. in the city to develop. Our biggest employer is VCU in the state. You can't tax them. Other localities provide incentives when you think about Amazon, Tranlin, even like out at West Creek. Sometimes folks will say, we shouldn't do X because we should put that money into this other thing. And I'm just wondering about how you think about the city's role in business development, and how does the mayor fit into that?
Well, I think economic development is a very, very important tool to grow your city and also create the tax dollars to actually invest in what I think is the number one issue, poverty and public education. The mayor's role in that, though, is I see as twofold. The mayor has to be the individual who is aggressive in going out and getting the mm-hmm. right businesses and jobs for this for their city. And that's what I will do as the next mayor. I'm going to be aggressive in trying to attract, you know, everyone to Richmond. But if the deal doesn't work for Richmond and its taxpayers, that's where I move away from the table. I was like, you know what? Thank you guys for, you know, expressing interest.
Right.
But it just doesn't work. It doesn't work for me. The mayor's job also is to drive the narrative and around what these businesses will be doing for our city. In order for us to be a AAA bond rated city, we have to be financially flexible. You mm-hmm. only become financially flexible if you expand the tax base. So we are landlocked basically, right? And we have a number of nonprofit, entities that don't pay taxes.
Right.
And so we have to be flexible by expanding the tax base.
A little bit of creativity.
That's right.
I'm bopping my shoulders.
Yes, you're doing a good job. Right. And that means we have to, bring businesses in who are, number one, good corporate citizens who are going to invest in public schools. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's going to be on the top of my list when I sit down with any CEO moving forward. It's like,
An appetite for that? Like, whether it's broadband internet or what if we got businesses to adopt a school? Like, do you think
I think there is.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. Stone has invested. The Redskins have invested. I just don't think people know about it.
Mm-hmm.
But my thing is, like, I'm going to ask for a whole lot more than a couple $100,000.
Right.
You got to go big. And so if you're the right corporate citizen that this city needs and desires, oh, yeah, I'm coming for you.
Yeah.
And I think that's the role that the mayor can play, I think. But I do believe we've rolled out the red carpet for some of the entities that we've named earlier. But we haven't rolled out that same red carpet for Richmond taxpayers,
mm-hmm.
Particularly some of the small businesses and startups here in the city. They see the ease of some of these entities to do business with the city. And they're like, what am I, chopped liver?
Right.
I've been here for 5-10 years trying to make it happen here in Richmond.
Right.
And you guys get, they get a permit, in a matter of weeks. And I got to wait 6 months to get a permit? That's not right. That's not right.
Yeah.
You don't treat the people who've been around here for so long that way.
I've been here. Right, right.
That's what I want to do as mayor. I want to roll that red carpet for them as well. We want to roll the red carpet for the world. Why can't we roll the red mm-hmm. carpet for the people who've been investing in Richmond for a number of years, every single day?
LeVar Stoney, do you want to play a fun round, a game that
All
I
right.
like to call?
I'm rubbing my hands.
I think it would be overselling to call it the lightning round because we'll probably banter a little bit, but it is
dun,
the...
Dun, 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 dun. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I will call it... No, that's the theme song. I will call
you
it
You forgot
the,
to do that, though.
Yeah. Well, I knew that you were going to step in.
cue the music.
So it's called the moderately paced round of questions.
Okay.
I have 5 of them.
All right.
LeVar Stoney, are you ready to play?
All right. I'm ready to go.
All right, he's intense. question number one, it's about fashion. You're no stranger to a good collar on a shirt, and I often notice that like your shirt and tie combination is usually very strong. Can you give me a single fashion tip?
Single
Not based
fashion.
On what I'm wearing, but just like in general. When you shop for like a shirt and tie, what are you looking for?
I like plain ties mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are easier to match with different shirts. I'd rather have a little bit more color and little design in my shirt than I would have in my tie. That's sort of my, that's just my style. Now, my team would rather me wear more plain shirts, more solid shirts, and I'm doing a better job at doing that because it's, I guess it makes me more mayoral, I guess.
It's about collaboration too.
Yeah, yeah. I get that. Also, I got to say though, you got to have a sock game. If you don't have a sock game, I mean, your sock game has to be strong. I mean, and, you know, the governor, you know, a good friend of mine, he thinks I'm overcompensating for something by having such a strong sock game. I think it just adds a little personality.
I would argue the opposite.
There you go.
I think there are very few places on a man's wardrobe where he can express a little bit of personality.
That's right.
I can't wear crazy pants or a crazy hat.
That's right.
Socks, maybe like cufflinks, but I'm not a cufflinks guy.
Yeah. I think socks are where to go. And so, you know, my number one thing when I wake up in the morning is I go to the sock drawer and I'm like, what am I feeling like today?
Sock drawer, build from there.
Mm-hmm.
Question number two, television. What was your favorite TV show growing up?
Favorite TV show growing up? I was a big TGI Friday guy, TGIF.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I really, but also, I would say Fresh Prince of Bel-Air was a strong one.
Mm-hmm.
You're not supposed to say Cosby Show anymore, so you just kind of... we won't even touch that, you know, right?
Fair. That's fair.
But yeah, Fresh Prince and many of the shows on TGI Friday, so like Full House, Family Matters.
Family Matters. Steve Urkel. Yep.
Those were my top ones right
the
there.
The staples.
Mm-hmm.
Question.
New York Undercover, too. I like that. Remember that on Fox?
Oh, yeah.
That was strong.
New York Undercover.
Mm-hmm. Question, 21 Jump Street.
21 Jump Street. Man, you could just go for days.
Mm-hmm. 90210.
Question number three, LeVar Stoney. I want to ask about one of your heroes. You recently were quoted, you were having a conversation about Maggie Walker. You said Maggie Walker was a hero.
Mm-hmm.
And then you said, check that. She is a shiro. Is that right?
Shiro.
Mm-hmm. Which I'm assuming is a female hero.
That's right.
Who is one of your shiros?
One of my shiros, outside of Maggie Walker? We already got that question.
Yeah.
I answer. I gotta say my grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, you know, we talked about this earlier. She was a very, very strong character. She wasn't quiet. She let you know what's on her mind. Some would say I have some of her characteristics today, like she would never let anything go. And my brother, the folks who are in my inner circle will say, like, you never just let it go. You just keep on going. I was like, yeah, that's just me. I think I learned that from somewhere. And, you know, she just had this great resolve that, you know, she may have not expressed verbally to us sometimes. I mean, she always expressed her love for us. But she never expressed this like deep inner ability to simply survive,
mm-hmm.
no matter what the conditions are. She just had that. You know, like, you know, maybe some people are. I don't think you can really learn that. You're born with that.
Right.
And she's dealt with a lot in her life, and she just always survived.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I got a little of that in me, and I think that comes from, as you said earlier, a little grit, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, no matter what the situation is going to be, no matter what the, you know, what the environment is going to be, I'm going to be all right.
Yeah.
We're going to survive this.
She sounds like a real shiro.
She is.
Question number four. This is a sports question.
Here we go.
Who is your favorite non-Jordan athlete of the 90s?
I got a couple. Deion Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
I like the fact I was not this sort of football player that was like really flashy and danced and all that stuff. But I loved his swagger though.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I love the fact that, like, you know, he's like, throw it over here. I'm coming for it. Like,
yep.
You know, I love that. I love that, but also I love the silent leader as well, the person who got it done without the fanfare. And that would be Warren Moon, who was an African American quarterback who was my favorite player growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Number one for the Houston Oilers back in the day. Like, that was my man.
Warren Moon. All right. This is the final question, question number five. This is a multiple choice. There are four options of this multiple choice.
Mm-hmm.
Each option has some type of play on your name. Are you ready?
Here we go.
All right. So the question is, which one of the following would you most like to have dinner with?
Okay.
A, Stone Cold Steve Austin. He's a wrestler.
I remember.
B, the Rolling Stones, rock icons.
Mm-hmm.
C, LeVar Burton, you might know him from Roots, reading Rainbow, mm-hmm. Star Trek later, mm-hmm. or C, Sly and the Family Stone, funk soul icons. Mm-hmm. I'll say them again, give you some time to think. This is important. Stone Cold Steve Austin, The Rolling Stones, LeVar Burton, or Sly and the Family Stone?
You know what? It would have to be LeVar Burton because he is truly my namesake. I was named LeVar because I'm obviously born 1981, conceived in 1980. What was the big miniseries at the time? Ah. Roots. My mother thought that he was attractive. And so she chose LeVar, and thank God not Kunta Kinte,
right.
as my name. And so my name is, I'm LeVar Marcus Stoney. Marcus is, my dad got the name of Marcus after Marcus Garvey. Back to Africa, mm-hmm. you know, black nationalist. And so, mm-hmm. you know, LeVar Stoney, LeVar Marcus Stoney. Yeah.
That's great.
So it'd be, you know, I want to tweet at LeVar Burton and say, hey, doing big things here in Richmond. Like, you know, could use some help, LeVar, you know?
Right. LeVar to LeVar.
Yeah, LeVar, like, you know, just to do a little LeVar to LeVar event. Like, you know, people grew up on this man. You know, I was actually on a radio show one time and they blasted the whole, like, Reading Rainbow, like, theme song and asked me to sing along. You're not going to do that here, are you?
Do you want to?
No. I don't think I know all the words.
Okay. I once, this is a true
butterflies
story.
Butterflies in the sky. I can fly twice as high. Okay. It's in a book, a reading rainbow.
Butterfly in the sky. I can go twice as high. Take a look. It's in a book.
A reading rainbow.
I can go anywhere. I know this song. Friends to know, ways to grow.
A reading rainbow.
Yeah. Then there's like the butterfly. That's great. Love it. Yeah, I may or may not have to prepare for that question. Today I Google searched famous LeVars, so I'll let you know if I find any others.
Okay. All right.
This has been a ton of fun. I have a final question that I want to close with. Mm-hmm. There's someone on the other end of this microphone. They're driving in the car. Mm-hmm. They got their earbuds in. Why should that person vote for LeVar Stoney?
Well, you know what? I think that this is a city that is truly on the rise. But I think Richmond finds itself at a crossroads, and the goal is always to get better. And I simply believe we don't get better with more of the same. We get better with something new. And I believe I provide that new energy, those new ideas and a new approach for us to actually just grasp it, you know, grasp what our future looks like. And, you know, I think this, yeah, people say this is an audacious thing you're doing. You know, we are going out there. We're chasing a lion here. That's what. Mm-hmm. That's the position I want Richmond to be in. I'm tired of Richmond being chased by defeatism and doubt and division. I want us to do the chasing now. It's our time. And I think if you believe that, you believe this is a city that, you know, you can raise your family here long term, that can be the model for governance, that can be mentioned in the same breath as Nashville and Charlotte and all these rising cities in the South. I'm asking you to join this campaign.
LeVar Stoney.
Thank you.
Thank you for being on the show.
This is great.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You can find out more about LeVar and his education plan on his website. That's stoneyforrva.com. StoneyForRVA.com. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Our theme, as always, is by No BS Brass. And Chris Payne is a guy that sometimes just wants to kick his feet up and tell everybody to chill. Thanks for listening.
Butterfly in the sky. I can go twice as high. Take a look. It's in a book. A reading rainbow. And ways to grow, a reading rainbow. I can be anything. Take a look, it's in a book, a reading rainbow. A reading rainbow.